Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, May 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president defends his firing of the FBI director as Democrats continue their outrage.
Any attempt to stop or undermine this FBI investigation would raise grave constitutional issues.
Russia's foreign minister meets with President Trump at the White House. The Paris Agreement, will the U.S. stay or will it pull out? Also ahead, a wildly popular singing competition is returning to the U.S. televisions. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, President Donald Trump is defending his move to fire Federal Bureau of Investigation Director James Comey. The president asked about it by reporters as he met in the Oval Office with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger.
Director Comey, why did you fire Director Comey?
Because he wasn't doing a good job, very simply. He was not doing a good job.
Critics of the decision say it raises questions about the FBI's probe into Russian meddling into the November presidential election and possible collusion between Trump campaign aides and Russian interests. Here to talk more about this is Charlie Price, who is works now as a consultant after spending more than 28 years as an FBI agent. Thank you for being with us. So what is your overall reaction to the firing of James Comey?
I find the events exceptionally disappointing and troubling. They raise a whole host of questions which need to be answered, and they create many, many appearance issues, and there's a lot of explaining that needs to be done. The stated reason that Attorney General Sessions has given for firing Director Comey is completely inconsistent with what Sessions said just last year when he was interviewed by Lou Dobbs on the Fox Business Network. At that time, Sessions said that Comey had an absolute duty to inform the American people about what he's found, and that he had stepped up and done his duty. And now he's firing Comey for the exact same thing.
In your experience, has the FBI become political?
Absolutely not. And that's what this is about, just the opposite, about making sure the FBI is not political. You know, the thing about Comey in the last year is that he has received criticism from both Republicans and Democrats alike. So if it's political, I don't know exactly what party Comey is,
right,
because he's getting hit by both sides.
Do you believe that the Russia investigation specifically is in jeopardy of going forward, or potentially won't be going forward anymore? Is it essentially over?
No, I think that this is an attempt. I think the ultimate motivator for these actions is, in fact, the investigation, not the email incident. But the apolitical people in the FBI, who are the backbone of the FBI, are not going to let that happen. On a pragmatic level, that investigation is going forward. It raises too many issues that are fundamental to our country. You know, this isn't over yet. The president has to nominate a new FBI director, and that new FBI director, whoever he or she may be, you know, is going to do whatever he or she is going to try to do. But what I'm saying is there are thousands, tens of thousands of career, professional, apolitical agents who have a vested interest in ensuring that the FBI stays independent.
Right.
Because the minute the FBI becomes a Republican FBI or a Democratic FBI or a Libertarian FBI, is the death of the FBI as an effective law enforcement organization. We rely on the trust and confidence in the American people.
Do you think that there could be a problem if it comes to light that he in some way tried to stop an investigation and that's why he let Mr. Comey go?
I mean, that's a hypothetical, but I think if Trump or anybody else who tries to interfere with an investigation for political reasons, yes, that would be trouble. The optics are horrible, because the question is, why now? This conduct that he's getting fired for occurred in July and October of last year. If it's fireable, why didn't he fire him on January 21st? Why didn't he fire him on February 21st? Why didn't he fire him on March 21st? Why now? Why does he fire him now while the Department of Justice Inspector General is conducting an independent investigation? Why doesn't he wait until the end of the independent investigation? Why does he have to fire him at the end of the day when Comey isn't even in town?
It was my understanding that President Trump was pleased with what James Comey did regarding Hillary Clinton's emails.
That's what he tweeted. So that's another question, and you raised a good question. There are many, many questions that are unanswered here. These actions raise a ton of questions.
Do you think that the firing sends a message to others within the agency that if you don't get in line, you're out? Or do you think that, that this is mainly up at the top of the, at the highest levels here?
I think it certainly could send that message. But I think in reality, it has the opposite effect. I think it steals the resolve of the agency as a whole to resist being politicized.
Given the political climate that we are in, do you think it's possible for the public to ever learn the truth about what happened with Russia's involvement in our election, and if there ultimately was any collusion?
Well, absolutely I do. And right now, as we speak, there are agents that are going about trying to find out answers to those questions, and those agents won't stop.
You were in the FBI some 28 years. That's a long time. Have you spoken to any of your former colleagues? Are they upset? Are they concerned? What can you tell me about what people are feeling within the agency at what has happened?
I have spoken with a large number of my colleagues, and yes, they are upset. They are very concerned for our agency and its independence because we are apolitical. And this is very, very, very extremely disturbing because it looks to be a political move. This is an incredibly important matter. The FBI has to be independent.
All right. We appreciate your taking the time to talk to us. That's retired FBI agent Charlie Price. Well, President Donald Trump met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov Wednesday at the White House. They discussed the need to work together to end the conflict in Syria, and Trump stressed the administration's commitment to resolve the conflict in Ukraine. It was Trump's first face-to-face meeting with a top-level Russian diplomat since he took office in January.
We're going to do very well with respect to Syria. I think things are happening that are really, really, really positive. We're going to stop the killing and the death. We had a very, very good meeting with Mr. Lavrov.
Jonathan Adelman, a professor of international studies at the University of Denver, on the president's thinking regarding meeting with Russian officials.
He clearly is confident that he can make some progress here. And that's basically what he was saying, that there are issues that the United States and Russia could get together on, possibly Iran, although mainly on Russian terms, and that will be a problem as well.
The two leaders were said to have spoken mostly about a Russian proposal for de-escalation zones in Syria to quell the civil war. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Experts foresee a growing friction between Trump and South Korea's new president. The death toll mounts in Venezuela's protests. Arson is suspected in a Rome fire that killed three sisters. And Cuba is a huge opportunity for U.S. travel companies. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The foreign ministers of the eight Arctic Council nations will meet to discuss climate change this week amid news last month that temperatures in the pristine region are warming at twice the rate of the rest of the world. A high-level meeting with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and his counterparts from Russia, Greenland, Canada, Norway, Finland, and Sweden, also Iceland, begin on Thursday in Fairbanks. Now, as Tillerson joins the talks, the Trump administration has not yet made a decision about remaining in the U.S. or the U.N. Paris Climate Agreement. Any changes to the climate policy of the U.S. would have a direct impact on the lives of Alaskan natives who depend on the Arctic Sea to survive. On Tuesday, the White House announced that the president's postponing his decision regarding the climate treaty for the second time. Here's Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
The president has been meeting with his team for quite a while on this matter, and he will not be making an announcement regarding that agreement until after he returns from the G7.
European Union leaders and former President Barack Obama have joined the chorus of voices emphasizing the need for action to reduce greenhouse emissions worldwide.
The good news is that in part because of what we did over the last 8 years, the private sector has already made a determination that our future is in clean energy. Investments are already moving into clean energy.
Well, joining me now for more is Jeff Gracer, an environmental attorney with the New York firm Cy Paget and Reisel. Before we get to the climate agreement, though, this week we learned that the Trump administration will not be reappointing half of the members of the Board of Scientific Counselors. Can you tell us exactly what this board does?
Well, this is a group of scientists that advise EPA on scientific issues involving human health and the environment, and it's purpose is self-evident, to do the best science that can be done to protect the American people.
Is it possible they just won't replace them like they've done with so many positions at the State Department?
I guess that's a possibility, but it appears that they're looking to replace certain people with certain points of view with others who share their points of view. But we'll see. We'll see who the people are.
Is this something that could leave the administration open to another lawsuit?
I don't know whether those appointments could be subject to judicial review. But the more important question is whether the science, it does have integrity, and whether this leads EPA in a direction that would trigger litigation because their position simply wouldn't be justified.
And now, despite the uncertainties about the U.S. remaining committed to the Paris Climate Accord, there are meetings happening in Europe right now as they try to find ways to implement the 2015 Paris Agreement to cut carbon emissions. But there's a lot of uncertainty going on as to the U.S. role.
There's a small group of U.S. government representatives meeting at that meeting. I'm sure that they have a rather restricted mandate at this point because it appears the White House is still considering what position it will take with respect to Paris. I think that it's quite remarkable and notable the depth and breadth of outpouring of support for the White House staying in, or the government staying in, the Paris process. It includes several former secretaries of state in Republican administrations. It includes conservative foreign policy experts who believe that there could be broader collateral damage to the U.S. position well beyond the climate change issue and foreign policy negotiations. It includes a very, very wide array of major corporations who are all saying that it would be better to stay in the process.
Any indication as to whether they are listening?
Well, it appears that they are taking this seriously.
Mm-hmm.
There have been several meetings scheduled to discuss it that have been postponed. A decision has not been made. My sense, although I don't know, but my sense is that the outpouring of support from not just the likely suspects, but from a lot of people who have deep conservative credentials is giving them pause.
If the U.S. were to pull out of the Paris Agreement, what impact would it potentially have globally?
Well, in terms of climate change policy, I think it would cede the leadership position to China and to other countries that will likely remain engaged in the process. The center of gravity in terms of jobs creation could shift to other countries. So just within the frame of climate change itself, that would be a very unfortunate development. But beyond that, I think the drawing from an international arrangement that enjoyed such broad support, I think there are only two countries in the world that are not part of it, Syria and Nicaragua. To withdraw from that could have much broader implications in terms of whether the United States can be relied upon to keep its commitments. I would also note, however, that there's a tremendous amount of flexibility in the Paris Agreement for this administration to adjust its approach by revising its approach in light of the recent elections. So the people who claim that withdrawal is necessary to protect U.S. interests, and in particular the interests of this administration, I believe are taking positions that are not well-founded.
That's Jeff Gracer, an environmental attorney with the New York firm Cy Paget and Reisel. Thanks so much for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues. Turning now to entertainment news with Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Nicole, I hear you have some news about a very long-running and very popular talent show that we thought had run its course.
So American Idol is coming back. It went off the air in 2015. It was previously broadcast on Fox, and now ABC has picked it up. We don't have a lot of details right now about what they're planning to do. I've heard whispers that Kelly Clarkson, who was the first ever American Idol winner, is being tapped to come back as a judge. Ryan Seacrest just started his new job with Kelly Ripa on Live with Kelly and Ryan. There's speculation, is he going to be coast to coast and be able to do them both? I don't know yet. He said he's open to it, and Kelly Ripa gave her seal of approval. So we'll just have to see. Apparently, ABC is pitching a big plan for the reboot to their advertisers later this month, and so we should know more then.
Wow, that's pretty big news. I can't imagine Ryan Seacrest taking any more on than he already has. My goodness. Although I can't imagine the show without him hosting it.
That big, bright smile that he had, and he was always so nice to the contestants. I don't know who they'll bring back. But it is interesting because I've heard that Simon Cowell may not be coming back, and he kind of was the bad boy of the show. So I think people would miss that.
For sure. And I hear you have some news about gold medal gymnast Simone Biles. She was also on a reality show.
Yes, she is currently competing in Dancing with the Stars, and she is headed to the semifinals next week. The season's about to wrap up. And this week, she did like a very sultry, sexy trio with her partner and another professional dancer. And the judges kind of gave her some criticism because she didn't smile enough. And she made everybody laugh because she came back with this sassy comment. She said, "Well, smiling doesn't get you gold medals."
Ooh.
And if you remember from Rio, she was very intense, very focused. But then at the end, when she stuck that landing, you did see that big, beautiful smile. So it was pretty funny, and it blew up on Twitter on Monday night. So I definitely think that she could be this year's champion on Dancing with the Stars.
All right. Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella, thank you so much. Time now to check out what's been trending on social media, and for that, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what are people talking about today?
We'll start with Betsy DeVos. Betsy DeVos is the U.S. Secretary of Education, and she was in the state of Florida on Wednesday to give a commencement address to the graduates at Bethune-Cookman University. It's a historically black college and university, or HBCU. And as DeVos began speaking, students and guests started booing her. The graduates got up and turned their backs on her. Part of the reason for that is because she is a member of the Trump administration, and I believe that African Americans were the largest group voting for Hillary Clinton and not for Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election. And also in February, DeVos said that historically black colleges and universities were pioneers of school choice. However, it wasn't that they had to choose to go there. For many black students, it was the only place they could go to attend college. So lots of diverse opinions on this on social media. Some said it was disrespectful, that the students should have heard her out. Some said it was a meaningful protest and a great way to mark their time at end of time in higher education, getting their bachelor's degrees and master's degrees. Some said that DeVos was trying to build bridges and cited lines in her speech where she said that she wanted to hear people out and wanted to start a conversation. However, some say, going back to that February incident, that she's using historically black college as a photo op. So not a lot of love there from some. But whatever your opinion was about the speech, tons and tons of video of the speech from inside the arena where it was happening. You have different parts of the speech that are excerpted when people were booing. You have video from people in the stands. You have video from the floor where the students were. You have students actually taking video and putting it up on social media, so you're seeing it from their perspective. So this is very widely covered all over social media, and it's why Betsy DeVos was trending all through Wednesday.
What were the videos? Did they have any common theme, or was it just all over the place?
There were a lot of clips from the speech that you saw again and again. There was one part where she said she was going to visit the university's namesake founder, visit her house and her gravesite and pay her respects, and everyone said no and started shouting no. A lot of clips from the beginning of the speech when she started speaking, that's when all the students got up and turned around and started booing. And then another clip where the university president told the students that unless they sat down, he'd be mailing them their diplomas and they wouldn't get to walk and receive them. After he made that comment, a lot of students did sit down, but some remained standing throughout the duration of the speech.
Wow. What else is trending?
So another name that's trending, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, a member of the Trump administration, deputy press secretary in the Trump administration. Maybe not a household name, but she's been trending on Wednesday because she took the podium in the briefing room to talk about the firing of FBI Director James Comey, which is in and of itself a huge trending topic continuing to trend. And she had some very strong words about Democrats wanting to investigate this firing. She accused them of hypocrisy. She said that if Hillary Clinton were president, and thank God she's not, she said, she would be firing him and Democrats would be dancing in the street. So very fiery language from Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And of course, this has split the internet. Republicans say that she's the new darling of the Trump administration. Kellyanne Conway, one of President Trump's advisors, kind of formerly held that spot. Mm-hmm. She's had some very contentious interviews. She was trending actually on Tuesday after the Comey firing because she had a very heated exchange with journalist Anderson Cooper, and he rolled his eyes at her, and that became a gif all over social media.
Right.
But that aside, Sarah Huckabee Sanders getting a lot of attention now instead of Kellyanne Conway from the right. From the left, they're seeing her as the new voice of the Trump administration, someone else who's espousing their views, the Democratic foil, saying that she's combative, that she's nasty to the press. And many wondering who is going to play her on Saturday Night Live. Of course,
only a matter of time.
Only a matter of time. Of course, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was portrayed by actress Melissa McCarthy. That got a lot of attention on the long-running U.S. Comedy sketch show. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if somebody makes an appearance as Sarah Huckabee Sanders. There have been some names offered up of different actors and actresses that could play her. But we'll see if she indeed makes the cut and gets portrayed and skewered on Saturday night.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, a new take on the Alien series from director Ridley Scott, Alien Covenant, opens in U.S. theaters. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the film continues the story begun in 2012's Prometheus, and in the second film in the Alien prequel series.
It's 2104, and the colony ship Covenant is headed for a remote planet with 2,000 colonists and 1,000 embryos. When their ship is damaged en route, the crew decides to set down on an Earth-like planet from which they have received a strange human transmission. Turns out that signal is coming from a ship piloted by the now-dead Elizabeth Shaw from the Prometheus mission. After a security team is killed by a neomorph, a new version of the alien species, the Covenant crew finds the android David, the sole survivor from the Prometheus mission. David, played by Michael Fassbender, has unleashed a gooey black weapon found during Prometheus' trip. He's also responsible for crossbreeding the earliest xenomorphs from a parasitic wasp. The battle between the xenomorphs and their infamous facehuggers and the human colonists makes up the rest of the movie. Director Ridley Scott says he wanted to explore different themes from the earlier Alien series and not just descend into blood and gore.
Oh, I think we opened up into a much larger universe than the others ever. The others did all action, shoot 'em out, kill, kill, kill. And I thought they should have answered various questions from the first one, which would enable us to open up that universe into a much more interesting way, other than just monsters chasing people down corridors. So I think this one has really got into creation under that heading. That's a massive discussion. But creation also being kicks off with the creation of an AI.
Michael Fassbender plays both David and Walter, two artificial intelligence droids that serve as caretakers to the humans. But Walter is more protective of the humans, whereas David sees them as possibly expendable. Fassbender says the prologue to the film shows the tension between preserving human life and survival of the fittest.
That little prologue at the beginning of the film is almost like a short film, mm-hmm. with the theme at the center of it, which is going to be revisited in the film itself, which is this thing about we created an AI, they start to see our vulnerabilities and our weaknesses and start to consider why they shouldn't be running the show. You know, and I thought that that was that concept is a very real one, I think.
Catherine Waterston plays Daniels, a character similar to Sigourney Weaver's Ripley in the original Alien film, in that she leads the fight against a xenomorph in the narrow confines of the spaceship. Waterston says she tried to avoid thinking about comparisons to Weaver's iconic character.
All I did anyway was my best to create this new character who I thought was very specific and interesting, and I didn't really worry about what came before because I had a responsibility to Ridley to show up on set with courage and creativity and all that stuff that they expect of their directors expect of their actors. So if I had thought about those things, I probably wouldn't have been able to get out of bed in the morning, you know.
Fans of the Alien series can look for what they've come to expect: stomach-tightening suspense, jarring violence, dark corridors, and of course the slimy sharp-toothed maws of the xenomorphs. Alien Covenant is rated R for sci-fi violence, bloody images, language, and some sexuality and nudity. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Yemen's two-year conflict between the Houthi rebels and the country's elected government, supported by a Saudi-led coalition, has left the people of Yemen, in the words of Norwegian humanitarian leader Jens Egeland, facing a famine of biblical proportion. According to the United Nations, since the conflict broke out in March 2015, nearly 4,800 civilians have been killed and more than 8,200 others have been injured. At the same time, more than 3 million Yemenis have been displaced since the start of the crisis, and some 70% of the country, or nearly 19 million people, is in need of humanitarian assistance. Today, over 17 million Yemenis are at risk of starvation. The fighting has caused an economic collapse and severely restricted the importation of food, medicine, and fuel. Even before the crisis, Yemen relied on imports for 90% of its food and most of its fuel and medicines. This means that until the fighting stops, there is little chance Yemen will be able to stave off the looming humanitarian catastrophe on its own. The United States is one of Yemen's largest donors of aid. In late April, the U.S. government announced nearly $94 million in additional humanitarian assistance to help the people of Yemen. This brings the total U.S. humanitarian contribution to Yemen to nearly $526 million since the 2016 fiscal year. The funds will go toward food and clean drinking water to vulnerable families, as well as nutrition treatment for malnourished children. It will also provide hygiene kits to fight the spread of disease, as well as life-saving medical supplies and training for healthcare workers. There will also be emergency shelter for those who had been displaced by the fighting. Conflict is the primary driver of this humanitarian crisis. The United States remains committed to providing humanitarian support to the people of Yemen while we work to end the conflict through a comprehensive peace agreement. The United States calls upon all parties to ensure unimpeded access for commercial and humanitarian goods throughout the country. We also urge other humanitarian donors to increase their level of support during this critical time of need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.